A brief listener game to begin with, and then a couple of looks at what the new normal might look like. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 28th of April, I do believe. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to pause here as we get going for, as I said, a very brief listener participation game. It is social distancing approved. Don't need anybody but you and your ingenuity to play. The prompt goes like this. The Federal Reserve wraps up a two-day meeting tomorrow. Chair Jay Powell is going to have a press conference. Your challenge is this. What is Jay Powell thinking? As always, five words or less. I'll give you my answer tomorrow on Twitter. Powell's due to speak at about 2:30 Eastern. All right, moving on. This seems like an opportune moment to remind you, all of us actually, that we are going to have to adjust our expectations. Should you, for instance, be in the market for a new iPhone? Yeah, not so fast. Apple's supply chain is said to have hit a snag, delaying production by about a month. And yes, the global manufacturing hub that is China is nominally back online, but as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, especially now, supply chains are tricky things.
Nick Dromboski is the founder of Wire Rides, which sells and leases electric scooters. At his factory in China, the newest model is almost ready, except for a couple parts.
We have like 90% of the components available to us, but there's just a couple pieces that we can't get. All it takes is one missing part to not have a finished product.
9 years ago, a tsunami struck eastern Japan, taking out the one plant that made one ingredient in auto paint and held up the industry for months. Dromboski doesn't know when his parts will come.
I guess the end of March, we got emails from pretty much everyone that we've ever done business with in China. It was like a copied and paste message saying, everything's great and our factory is fully reopened. Okay, can I get this? And they say, well, not yet.
One limitation may be factory workers, says Dexter Roberts. He's the author of The Myth of Chinese Capitalism. He says factory workers tend to be migrants from rural China who are struggling to return.
Either because of transportation disruptions or in many cases, they couldn't find a place to live. The locals there see them as outsiders and worried about the virus and didn't want them to come back.
And cranking things back up again is more than just China. A typical car assembled there has 30,000 parts that come in from multiple countries, some still facing the peak of the pandemic. Economist Susan Helper studies global supply chains at Case Western Reserve.
If these different countries are in different stages of the disease, have different policies about lockdown, I think these reopenings are not going to be smooth.
Still, many analysts think things could have turned out far worse. Many businesses had just enough spare inventory. Demand for Chinese goods fell off when the rest of the world suffered from coronavirus. And Chinese factories went down for only 3 weeks, says economist Sean Dubravac at the Electronics Manufacturing Trade Group, IPC.
Had the delay been months as opposed to weeks, I think the impact would have been much more acute.
He says every time there's a disruption in manufacturing, whether it's a virus or a trade war, supply chain pros learn new lessons. One solution now widely discussed is to bring some manufacturing closer to home in key industries like medical supplies. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Housing data of this Tuesday show just how strong that market was before. The latest Case-Shiller National Home Price Index shows prices were up more than 4% in February, and says the Census Bureau, there were 2.7 million new homeowners in the first quarter of the year, with the home ownership rate rising to just above 65%. So that's the data. And just how much the market has softened since then is officially TBD. But it turns out being stuck at home is changing the way a lot of us think about our homes. Marketplace's Amy Scott is on that one.
Andrew Manis shares a 700-square-foot apartment in Nashville with his wife and their pit bull mix, which was fine when they went out all the time. But now the dog park is closed, and most days both humans are working from home.
The toughest thing has just been privacy.
When their lease is up next year, they're thinking about trying to buy a place, and not just with more indoor space.
You know, maybe some chickens and a big garden and a little bit of land and things that I thought were doomsday prepping kind of mindset are now things that I'm like, well, that would be, you know, kind of nice.
Realtor.com surveyed people about what they'd like to change about their homes after quarantine. Senior economist George Ratu says more space topped the list, indoors and out, followed by
updated kitchens, right? Not surprisingly, given that we are spending so much more time cooking at home.
But with many people out of work and the economy so uncertain, a lot of these upgrades may have to wait. Abby Will at the Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies expects an uptick in smaller DIY projects.
But of course, you know, the bulk of remodeling spending really is major home improvements. And we think homeowners are dreaming about doing those projects, but are not likely to undertake them anytime soon.
With plenty of time to dream about his next home, Lindsey Crosby in Auburn, Alabama, knows what he doesn't want.
We're beginning to rethink the open concept.
You know, the big kitchen that opens out to the dining and living room that has been all the rage.
We love our kids, but we're not used to being around them every minute of every day.
Amen. There's something to be said for walls and doors. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Same, Amy. Same. Quick plug here before we go on. If you miss us on the air, first of all, we podcast to all the shows and we got newsletters, marketplace.org/newsletters to subscribe. Equities today, kind of a wash. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here we are in a time when a lot of people need a lot of help, and you run a company where that's basically the mission statement. GoFundMe is a fundraising platform, individuals, organizations, businesses, and it's not unusual after a disaster or a crisis for there to be a whole lot of GoFundMe activity. This thing, though, is a whole new level. Tim Cadogan is the CEO of GoFundMe. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Kai. It's a pleasure to be here.
You started this job like first week of March, and then a week later, the bottom falls out pretty much of the global economy, right? What was that like?
Yes, I started on March the 2nd, and it was a lot of learning. We decided at the end of that week to go full work from home. So from my point of view, I had a week to meet my new company. I was very, very impressed with how the team reacted to that and focused very quickly, refocused on doing what we do, which is helping people help each other, which has been incredibly important in the crisis that we're all dealing with.
Yeah, it absolutely has. Tell me what you are seeing along those lines. I mean, what trends, what is of note to you?
Well, the first is probably obvious, which was we're seeing an unprecedented level of activity. And the way I think about that is unprecedented generosity. Then what we're seeing from a trending point of view is typically as a country is affected, the first wave of activity is around medical workers and PPE and equipment. That then is shifting to small businesses and their employees. And that then is shifting deeper into the impact with areas like food security, rent relief, and then starting to touch on the more hidden factors like mental health. And we're not yet seeing much around recovery, which is sort of the typical pattern for a disaster. We're still very much in the middle of it.
Yeah. Could you see this through your data sort of hopscotching across the globe? I mean, we saw it, you know, epidemiologically, but I imagine you saw it as well, right? From China,
100%.
Italy and Iran. And,
yes. Now, we don't operate in China. We're operating about 20 markets, particularly, you know, the U.S. and the European markets. But as it came into Europe, particularly Italy, you could see very, very clearly the movement of the impact on these societies and how people are responding. And really, in that second week of March here in the U.S. is when activity just went to very, very high levels and essentially has stayed there since.
So this is it's a little bit sideways and it's a little bit subjective, but I'm sure you and others in this company have thought of this. It's clear that you are a social safety net, specifically in your operations in this country. You're a social safety net for people who don't have a social safety net. And I wonder what you take away from that as you do your job every day.
Well, it was one of the reasons I came to the company is I wanted to come work for a company that had a massive impact on people. there are elements of a safety net in nearly all the countries we operate in, some more, some less. But any government-supported safety net tends to come from above, whereas what we do is we enable people to connect with their friends, their family, in the case of small businesses, their patrons and supporters. And it has an emotional side to it that, say, a bigger government-type programs don't, because you are helping those that you know and care and love about.
In an ideal world, I suppose, this is going to sound like a weird thing to say to the CEO, in an ideal world, you go out of business, right? Because there's no longer a need for your services.
I think we occasionally do think about that. I think we're all pretty clear that we're very far from a utopia. I think the other thing, though, to bear in mind is I don't think there will ever be a limit to the desire to people to help each other. One of the things that is going on is, as so many of us are at home, we can't take action in the normal ways. You can't go and volunteer somewhere. You can't provide your physical help. So providing a donation is a way to take action. And most psychology studies will show you one of the most powerful ways to feel better is to give. And I think it's a very, very powerful underlying human need, and one that I think will remain in any society that we can envisage.
Tim Cuttigan, he is the CEO of GoFundMe. Tim, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So here's a truly terrifying thought, and you're going to think I'm exaggerating, but really, I think you'll see I'm not. There is going to come a time, if this thing goes on long enough, when we are going to run out of new content. I mean, yes, sure, you can watch old stuff, but come on. Thing is, with production shut down, the whole entertainment supply chain is shut down as well. On-screen talent, yes, but also caterers and makeup artists and camera operators and key grips, whatever those are. So like a lot of industries, Hollywood is already talking about what getting going again might look like. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst is on that one.
A couple of weeks ago, actress Kiki Melendez had an audition for the TV show NCIS, but she was told not to come in.
You know, I recorded myself and sent it to them.
Melendez hasn't heard back yet. NCIS halted production due to COVID-19. And even when Hollywood does restart, a lot will change. There's talk of on-set staff getting tested regularly for the coronavirus. Studios are reportedly thinking of limiting the use of extras.
That is horrible for the industry. I mean, when I first came here, that was how I got all my experience. Yeah, that's how I supported myself.
And other ideas are on the table, says Frank Patterson, president of Pinewood Atlanta Studios, where Marvel movies like The Avengers are filmed.
Yeah, one of the ideas that a number of the studios are working on is quarantining those teams or having them stay together and travel together and work together.
He expects less filming on location. It's just easier to control a closed studio environment than, say, the streets of New York. And the big question, of course, is when is all this going to even happen? Some studios are hoping to start up again in July, but many say a fall reopening is more realistic. Colleen Bell is the executive director of the California Film Commission.
We don't know when reentry will take place, but we want to be prepared.
She says she's having ongoing discussions about what it will look like, because one thing is for sure, when Hollywood finally gets back to business, it won't be business as usual. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
You want new content? We got new content. Parks and Rec is coming back for a one-time special this week. We're going to have series creator and showrunner Mike Schur on the program tomorrow. Coming up.
If she couldn't make the system work so that she wouldn't need it anymore, then perhaps nobody could.
Perhaps. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off today 32 points, a 10th percent, 24,101. The NASDAQ down 122 points. That's 1.4% there, 8607. The S&P 500 gave up 15 points, a little more than a 0.5% there, 2863 is the number. 3M posted better than expected quarterly profits thanks in part to demand for its N95 masks. 3M picked up 2.5% on the day, 2.5%, of course, another way to say that. Wall Street Journal says Detroit automakers are aiming to restart production on May 18th. Ford Motor gained 4%. Fiat Chrysler added 1.1%. General Motors, on the other hand, gave up 1.2% today. UPS shares lost almost 6% after the shipper withdrew its revenue projections for the year, also canceled stock buybacks, and cut capital spending by $1 billion. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 0.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday is, of course, the first of the month, which means the 26 million people who've lost their jobs last 5 weeks and the millions more who've had their hours cut are going to have to pay another month's rent. There have been calls for rent strikes across the country or legislative relief of some kind because the crisis people are facing in paying for a place to live is real. But some of those landlords might need help, too. For this next installment in our series, Adventures in Housing, one person who lives on both sides of the landlord-tenant divide.
My name is Sarah Fryer, and I was a designer for a bathroom remodeling company, or I am, I guess, still, hopefully, when this all changes over. And I live in San Diego right now, but I own rental units in Chicago and Austin. I know that my tenants don't have months and months and months of rent saved up. I know what they do for a living. You know, I know that they're stuck at home. I know they're not working at the bar. They're not working at the shops they work at. And, you know, every month about $4,500 comes out of my checking account for these buildings. So, you know, that's not something I have just sitting around if I'm not working either, you know, or without the rents coming in. I called the mortgage companies, and what I ended up deciding to do was furloughing one of them and then bringing all of my tenants, which is there's 8 total, down to $500 a month each. If there's a point where they don't have that, I'm not going to ask them for anything. I'm not going to kick anyone out of their house. The thing is, I get why the idea, this vague idea of landlords is bad. I'm living in a giant rental building right now owned by a giant rental company that owns multiple properties who on the same day that I reached out to my tenants and my mortgage companies trying to figure out what we were going to do, they sent this like, it really pissed me off, actually, this letter to all the units that was like, just so you know, you still have to pay rent and all this stuff. And I was like, if you're in the business of sheltering people, then you should be in the business of sheltering people and you should do it correctly. And so to me, the safety of the people who live in my homes, you know, their well-being, I mean, they're paying my mortgages for me. Someday I would be an old person and hopefully own these buildings outright. Great. I don't have a 401k. I don't have, you know, a retirement plan in any other way. So like, when does the government step back in to help us in a time of crisis?
Sarah Fryer, she is in San Diego. Her tenants are in Chicago and Austin. Do us a favor, would you? And tell us about your adventures in housing. You can do that at marketplace.org. The flip side of that landlord-renter story we just heard is that just having a place to live at all was already out of reach for 500,000 Americans even before this whole crisis started. The catch about homelessness, of course, and the poverty that often goes along with it is that it doesn't look the same for everybody who's experiencing it. And the search for social services and public assistance can become almost overwhelming. Lauren Sandler spent a year following a young mother who was trying to get herself out of homeless shelters and out of poverty as well and into a stable place to live. Her new book is called This Is All I Got. Hi, Lauren. Good to have you on.
Hi.
Do me a favor and tell me, would you, the brief biographical sketch, I guess, of the woman you profile in this book. Her name that you have given her is Camilla.
Correct. I met Camilla in a shelter for expectant and new mothers in Brooklyn. She was 22, Dominican American. She was pregnant when I met her. And I spent a year navigating the social service system, navigating the first year of motherhood, and navigating a life of ambition and desire by her side. She's someone who had sued her parents for child support successfully when she was a teenager. She's someone who had rented her own room in Manhattan to get herself out of foster care. She's just this extraordinary woman. And it occurred to me that if she couldn't make the system work so that she wouldn't need it anymore, then perhaps nobody could. And, you know, it's not much of a spoiler to say that she couldn't.
One of the things that hit me in this book was how easy it was for Camilla to lose benefits. And there's an anecdote of her, like, missing a letter that had been mailed that, like, having missed that letter and not responded got her booted out of some program. I apologize, I forget. But it was stunning to me that that's all it took.
That is all it takes often. Or you show up for a May date with April paperwork. Or there's been some miscommunication about paperwork within the system. The number of possibilities to lose your benefits is infinite. And even for someone as tenacious and organized and just on it as Camilla, someone who can read every line of paperwork like she's an attorney, she still lost everything. And it was devastating to encounter.
She finishes an associate's degree, right? And makes the dean's list, I think?
She does. She actually made the dean's list around the time that she lost all of her benefits. She was actually going to be transferring into John Jay for criminal justice, you know, best criminal justice program in the country. The reason that she couldn't in the end was because she could find no housing in New York, so she could not go to school here.
There is a question to be asked about this book and about you, and it goes like this. Here's a woman on the lowest, I suppose, end of the income spectrum having these problems. You, at night, got to go home to your apartment in Brooklyn. Why are you the one to tell this story?
It's a key question, and I'm so glad that you asked it. You know, I've been a journalist for over 20 years. I write a lot about data and policy. I spend a lot of time thinking about systemic issues. Certainly, there are many other people who should be telling this story too. And it should not be that I am the person to tell this story. But I actually believe that my privilege gives me the responsibility to devote my work to the things that I can help shine a light on.
We are now in what certainly has the early signs of being the greatest economic crisis in a generation or more. And stories like Camilla's will become, I would guess, more prevalent. What hope do you have that among all the other flaws in this economic system that we have that are being laid bare by this crisis, attention will be paid to the one you describe in this book?
Well, I'm of two minds. I think it depends on my mood of the day. It looks really bleak a lot of the time. You know, it is stunning to me that we could come out of the best of times so ill-equipped for the worst of times, but it also doesn't surprise me. People have to feel the crisis in order to want to make the change. I am hoping very much that this is enough of a reset so that people will choose to feel something beyond their own needs and beyond their own interests, and that we have an opportunity to rethink what we can tolerate as a society. That said, that we couldn't make that happen in unprecedented prosperity makes me very nervous for what can happen in the worst of times now. I'm scared about it.
It's a book called This Is All I Got, A New Mother's Search for Home. Lauren Sandler wrote it. Lauren, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Kai, thank you so much. Take care.
You too. We've got an excerpt from Lauren's book for you to read. It is, of course, at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, I saw this one in the Los Angeles Times. It's kind of a public service announcement, actually. If you have been entering your data and entering your data and entering your data at IRS.gov to find out where your relief check is and you have gotten payment status not available, try this. Enter your street address in all capital letters. Yes, it'll look like you're yelling, but apparently it gets results. I don't know. All right, we are out of here. The Dow Industrial is down 32 points today. That's a 10%. The NASDAQ lost 122 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 gave up 15, a little more than a half percent there. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Field, Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, and Erica Phillips. Tara Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.